Blog Talk Radio.
Peace to the ancestors. Yes. Peace to Dr. Cornell West. Yes. Peace to the movement. Yes. We came from the bottom. Ever since they got us, we've been going through these problems. 400 years behind, and it's no promise that we gon' never actually be equal, to be honest. It's messed up how they put us in chains, kidnapped our language and changed our names. But when we speak Ebonics, then they call it a shame. They leave us with a couple options, rob or slain. Now we locked up a game. How much can our skin take? We went from slaves to inmates, carrying the weight of the 50 states, working your forms. Black nannies carrying white babies in their arms. Black men sacrifice their lives in your wars, but you don't never show appreciation here at home. You treat us so damn wrong. You act like you hate my race. The police, they just beat us in the streets like an 808 base. America, when will you defend my case? It never will, cause your freedom is fake. I'm only living here cause I wanna get paid enough to round up all my family and shake.
Get up, get up, get up, get up, get up, get up.
Worst case scenarios, might work till a couple of quirks. Can't call it pancakes cause you pour some syrup. It's a whole lot bigger than a pretty new house, especially when the rodent's still running about. P. Diddy running marathons, raising dough. That's going to the school where the tax money go. Homeland Security, now there's a phenomenon. Pacifying folks by hanging Saddam. Truth still riding, still obliging, still no Bin Laden. Tuned in waiting for the president's announcements. No 40 acres, take these 40 ounces. We ain't gon' get on the levees. Revolution televised early. Is you ready?
Why you wanna treat me so cold, America?
Being forced to climb instead of how you back, have you beat and lost your mind? Especially when you done been down for so much time. Getting up don't even really ever cross your mind. You got pawn shop, gun shop, liquor store time. SWAT team, crack fiends, unemployed line. Stay late, dollar short, trying to buy time. What we do to survive is defined as a life of crime. You can't ball, then you forced to grind. If you fall, then you cross the line. And I've been putting in work from 9 to 5 and 5 to 9. Since phone calls cost a dime. What it made me is one of the relevant, highly intelligent brothers not only dealing with that same drug selling. If I'm a hustler, then what's more American? We all founded on the same drug
America,
heritage.
Why you wanna treat me so cold, America?
You know the black freedom movement, constitution, moral conscience. You know we've been trying to redeem the soul of the nation. Even as that nation's been trying to render us soulless, but we're our soulful people, the blues people. We've been keeping alive the same banner of democracy. Thank God for those who came before. We shall never forget them and always move forward with grace and dignity.
America, why you wanna treat me so cold? America,
America, are you ready for another exciting show? Dr. Mary Lee live coming from the East Coast. I'm Dr. Tatum emanating from the West Coast in California. We have an exciting program. We've been doing a series dealing with critical race theory, the racism in America, part 3. Tonight we'll be talking about solutions. The song you just heard was by Dr. Cornell West on Hidden Beach Records back in 2007. My oldest son, Corey Cote Tatum, did the music. The first rapper was Iris was my youngest son, followed by Rod Digger and Black Thought. And the last person you heard on that song, America, was Dr. Cornel West. We have an exciting lineup tonight. Our guest will be Mark Bland. He is the Chief Diversity Officer at IHS Marquette, and will be our guest tonight. And I'm going to turn it over to one of our co-hosts, Dr. James Cannon. He is the father of entertainer Nick Cannon, who is the co-producer and co-host with Dr. Mary Lee Live for the 400 HR 1242. Nick Cannon is our ambassador. Dr. Cannon, are you with us tonight? And if he's not with us, we're going to turn it over to Michael Tynes until James Cannon chime in. So, Michael Tynes, the ball is in your court.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Tatum. Can you hear me okay, first of all? Let me just make sure I can be heard.
Yes, we hear you.
Okay, excellent. Yeah, hello. Welcome to Dr. Mary Lee Live. My name, as Mr. Tatum said, is Michael. I'm a fellow co-host of the show and a community advocate of Foundation Black American Economic and Intellectual Independence. On tonight's show, we'll be continuing our discussion regarding solutions for Black America, still within the socio-political context and climate of critical race theory. But before we get into the discussion, I want to pass it over to Dr. Mary Lee so she can give her opening remarks as well as introduce some of our guests that we're going to be speaking with later on in the show. Dr. Mary Lee, are you there? Dr. Mary Lee? All right, well, if Dr. Mary Lee isn't there, or maybe she can't hear me, then we'll see Dr. Cannon.
I'm so sorry. I'm here.
Okay.
I'm so sorry. I want to thank you all. I placed my phone on mute, and then I end up talking without taking it off of mute. But I was saying I thank you all. I appreciate you all so very much. Well, thank you, Dr. Tatum. Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Dr. Cannon. He will be with us probably in just a little bit. So I want everyone to know that we appreciate you, and we're excited about tonight as we are speaking with a very important person and with who's going to bring some solutions to the table. We have been discussing the critical race theory. And we've been talking about, you know, the stereotypes and why some people don't want us to talk about critical or teach the critical race theory or history, okay? So for me, there's a difference between the theory and history. So teaching the history has turned into a so-called critical race theory, which got started, you know, some years ago. But as of late, it's become an issue. I mean, it's being utilized to, you know, a lot of degree in certain parts of the country to eliminate or the teaching of Black history, the whole history, the whole truth. And, you know, we've had lots of discussions around changing our textbooks in because of the awakening in our 400 years, and we've definitely been talking about the issues of our racial issues throughout the country. And now where we are is that we've done so much talking. It's only so much talking and so much history that we can talk about. It comes a time we have to find answers. We have to find solutions. And this is what we're here for. You know, the past 3 weeks, this is our part four. And second week of solutions, we're going to stay on solutions for a minute, for a while, three sessions here. And then we're going to start taking action. The whole idea here is to we presented the problems, plural, and Now we're talking about some of the things that we can do. We had great ideas last week. Last week we left off at Michael had presented to us the notion of our emotions, you know, how we get stirred up as a people. You know, we'll get out here, we'll march, and we do all these things. We get all excited. But then it just kind of fades down. It just fades away, you know, dies off. You can't stay motivated. And so, you know, we talked about that emotional state. And I think we might be still touching it. I think that, you know, this it is a critical issue for us as a people to carry things out, to really move forward, stay motivated, you know, continue to want to work. And so there's something that we hear that we really, really must address. And so this is very important, very important. That we as a people learn how to, you know, every day, we're not going to feel like, you know, coming to the show. Every day we're not going to feel like going to work. Every day we're not going to feel like we're going to be on the mountaintop and just ready to speak out and to do. So we have to push beyond those feelings and so those you can't just be emotional reaction. We can't just always be reacting, but then we want to be proactive. So we're talking about solutions. Then we're going to enact these solutions. Again, I want to thank you all for being here. I want you to, we do need you to we have background noises, so I do want to ask you to please mute your phone when you're not speaking, because we can hear and pick up the background noise. Our guests, our medical team, Dr. Tynes, Dr. Long, Dr. Moncrief, Dr. Walker Davis, if you're all here, please tap one on your phone so that we can get your line open. Okay, please remember to tap one on your phone so that we can get your lines open. Dr. Long, okay, Dr. Long, you should be open. And Dr. Tynes, you should be open as well. Okay. You're welcome, and thank you. Thank you so much for joining us. All right, so I think what we'll do is I'm going to go ahead and introduce our speaker for tonight is Mr. Mark Bland. He is Chief Diversity Officer at IHS Market. As the Chief Diversity Officer for IHS Market, I still need someone to please I can hear papers. I can hear a lot of background. I need someone to mute their phones. We don't want to ask everyone to be muted for one person from our side, because it just gives us more work to do. Mark is responsible for the development and enhancement of IHS Market business opportunities within the growing and diverse automotive market. In his role, Mark works across the IHS Market organization to ensure their broad suite of products and custom solutions address the unique marketing needs of those seeking to reach the growing African American, Asian, Hispanic, women, military, LGBT, and mobility, focused on individuals with perceived challenges, automotive communities. He is the co-founder of Diversity Volume Leadership Awards, which recognizes the top-selling vehicles to ethnic minorities, women, and LGBT community. Mark is also a highly sought-after speaker, and his thought leadership has been published in the following books: The 85% Niche, The Power of Women of All Colors, Latino, Black, and Asian, by Miriam Mooley. Black is the New Green, Marketing to Affluent African Americans by Leonard E. Burnett and Andrea Hoffman, and Black Steel Matters in Marketing by Pepper Miller, along with other highly respected publications, including Advertising Age, Automotive News, Black Enterprise Hispanic Business Magazine, The Michigan Chronicle, the TargetMarketNews.com. Okay. Marcus also received national and global recognition for his efforts in the growing diverse market, including 2011 Emerging Leader Award from Rainbow Push, 2012 Michigan Chronicle Man of Excellence, 2012 National Research Executive, and the year from Market News in Chicago, 2013 Diversity Executive of Distinction by Diversity Global Magazine, 2013 and 2017 Corp Magazine Salute to Diversity Award winner, 2013, 14, and 17 Global Diversity Innovation Award recipient by Diversity Journal Magazine, and was recognized by the National Association of Minority Automobile Dealers with the prestigious 2015 National Diversity Advocate Award. Adopting Cody, Loyola, and Pershing High Schools in Detroit while serving as a mentor to hundreds of future leaders over the past 17 years is another passion for Mr. Bland. The primary goal of his mentorship is to explain the unspoken rules of corporate America while providing the tools to be leaders within their community. A proud graduate of Frank Cody High and the Detroit Public School System, Mark holds a Bachelor of Science degree from Grand Valley State University and Master of Science degree from Central Michigan University. Welcome, Mr. Mark Bland.
Ooh, hey, thank you so much, Dr. Mary Lee. I really appreciate it. And also, I'd be remiss if I didn't thank Dr. Cannon and Mr. Michael Tynes. Of course, my friend, my dear friend and family member, Dr. Curtis Longs here in Detroit with me, and all the listeners that are sitting on the call listening to the Critical Race Theory, Racism in America, part four. But what I really like is that last word, solution. So thank you for having me, and I hope that I can contribute to a very positive conversation, focused not just on the problems, but I really want to help and hopefully walk away with at least one or two, three or four tactical and easily implement solutions that can help us address, you know, race theory and more importantly, racism in America. So thank you, everybody, and thank you, Dr. Lee, for having me.
And thank you so much. We're grateful, absolutely grateful for you to be here. Okay, so again, I'm asking everyone to mute their phones if you're not speaking. Okay, let's see. I want to be sure everyone is open. Okay, while I am doing this, I'm going to ask Michael, if you would just kind of recap our conversation, for the past, at least last week, and particularly the emotions part that you talked about last week.
Okay. Well, I don't know if I caught some of the earlier shows. I talked about last week's show. I can speak on that. I know we were finishing up last week near the end of the show. Again, you restated mentioning how as a community we seem to lose a lot of the passion that's dredged up or that's stimulated after certain controversial events in the media regarding, you know, racism and the socio-political condition that black people are in. And we also had someone call in, or someone on the panel, I believe, maybe a guest, mention, you know, opportunity that black people knew given by outside of our community in terms of employment, specifically, I think in a company in Georgia, I can't be too sure. And part of the discussion was really us trying to figure out whether there should be a hard line in the sand on integration solution and a non-integration solution that prioritizes ownership and control of the Black community and resources in the Black community and how we would get there. And the other side of the conversation, apart from the ownership debate as a solution, was, again, just ways of maintaining the passion that's ignited in Black people after, certain controversial race-based events are propagated in the media. I know Mr. Bland has experience in the corporate sector, so I don't know if he can hear me. Hopefully he can. I do want to ask a question, and then maybe we'll come back and, allow him to his introductory remarks and speak a little bit himself. He's into now, but I had one question for Mr. Bland. I know he's from the corporate sector, so he can probably speak to this. For the specific part of the corporate sector you work with seems to be data acquisition for marketing purposes. I just have to ask, what kind of data is collected about, let's say, Black people or the Black community that the company you work for factors into their projections, the calculations, if you will, in order to successfully sell to Black people? What types of data, if you don't mind?
Yeah, so first, again, I'll reintroduce myself. I definitely can hear you, Mr. Tyne. Again, I'm Mark Bland. I probably serve as Chief Diversity Officer for a company called IHS Market. We're public traded and we're global. But also, what I want to say is that in the industry of automotive, we're very proud to be the largest collector and analysis group, and also more importantly, we push that information back out to all facets of the automotive industry. And we're not a sample company, Mr. Tynes and the listeners. We're more of a census company. So how it works, you go out, register your vehicle, no matter whether you're driving a new or used vehicle. Let's talk about new. You register your vehicle on your birthday, we register that, we get a fee that information. It's been that way for over 100 years, and we're good, protectors of that data. But what we do is we've invested heavily in the best ethnic coding partners, not just in the United States, but in the world, and they're able to, collectively, we're able to identify the ethnicity of a vehicle registrant at over a 90% rate just by the information that you have on the vehicle registration, including first name, middle name, where available, last name, and where that vehicle is registered. So what we've done is made the entire automotive industry very smart and focused on what I call the future majority consumer, which is African Americans, Asian, Hispanic. Not because Mark Bland and my big mouth, which I do have one, and I promote it and use it to the benefit of those protected classes every opportunity I get, but because the U.S. Census and our own self-report has projected that those three consumer groups, which are currently looked at as the minority, by 2045, and I repeat, within 24 years from now, will become the majority population in the United States. And then I've been able to, with my platform, convince the auto manufacturers that not just the majority population, but the majority new vehicle consumer, which has heightened their focus and their efforts. So what that does at its highest point at a macro level is I've convinced the likes of the General Motors and Toyotas and Hondas, the Mercedes, the Lexus, and the like, everybody from A to Z, to say if you want to be sustainable from a consumer standpoint, not just now, but in the near future and the long-term future, you need to focus dollars, resources, and people to these protected classes, which, again, I call the future majority. And so now the end game of all that is you see more. I've seen more Black folks in national and regional TV campaigns this past year than you've seen. In addition, it has more Black and brown people working and ensuring their innate brain power, organic brain power, because we're born. I'm an African-American male. I know African-American inside out because that's where I live and breathe every day. And we're now part of the community, and we're becoming a bigger part every day to help these automakers create campaigns that are going to excite us and excite us and make us consider and ultimately buy the products and services that they're selling in the automotive industry. So did I ask your question, Mr. Ty?
Absolutely. We appreciate that.
Not a problem.
Okay. I guess we can, you know, get some introductory information out of you. How did you get into the field that you currently work in? What brought you to it? I know you said I don't know if you lived in Detroit, you spent some time in Detroit, and you went to school there in the education system there. How did this opportunity into this particular sector of, you know, the job force present itself to you when you were, you know, growing up?
Yeah, so not a problem. I'm always, again, and I'm saying this based on the third-party assessment, not me pop my own collar or talk. It's me hearing what other people said about me when they were watching through that third-party lens. Hey, I've heard comments like, Mark, you've always been a natural leader. No matter when I was playing little league sports, high school sports, ultimately I was blessed to get a college scholarship and play college football. I've been the captain on all levels. And so I guess that's a testament to I was the person that says, hey, if there's indecision on should we go right or left, I'll look at it, understand the pros and cons of each, and decide, you know what, I think the best thing for us to do is go right based on the best available data. So that in itself lends it to where I end up starting out, and I'm blessed to have gone that path to be a data analyst first and an IT professional first. So I know how to get in, massage, analyze, and find trends, KPIs, you know, key performance indicators, and future things based on raw data. So that's kind of the early beginnings. I'm just a natural problem solver combined with a natural leader, and I've been told that I can communicate pretty well, right? So that collection of talents led me to always be able to, and I guess I would say a natural socializer, right? You put me in a room with a room full of strangers, and I walk out with at least knowing half the room and probably 10 friends in the mix. So I'm not afraid because I was taught by my parents, Francis and Diane Bland, and my grandparents, God rest all their souls because I have none of them with me on Mother Earth right now. But what they instilled in me was, hey, get in, and it makes no sense to have the cure for cancer if you can't explain it to anybody. So don't sit there and be quiet. Get out there, let people know you were there. Stick that big hand of yours out and stick it out. Look people in the eye and they're doing, hi, I'm Mark Bland. What's your name? And just have a casual conversation because you never know what you're going to learn from somebody. But they instilled in me, you will learn something from everybody, whether it's good or bad. And so now I'm blending over to that. I'm trying to get you to understand me and who I am and who's on this call with you. Two things that my parents instilled in me is, one, when you know better, you do better. And I repeat, when you know better, you will do better. Those that don't have knowledge are prone to make mistakes because they don't know. But those of us that have done things, made the mistake, we can learn from that. We know what not to do. Those that have done things and have achieved success, we know what to do that we need to repeat. Now we have to get into the point where leaders come in where you need to share that information, right? And that goes to the second thing my parents instilled in me early on, which is lead by example. You want somebody to clean up their property and clean themselves, then you make sure your house is cleaned up and you make sure you present yourself in a professional way, thus leading to respect for your home and respect for you, your person. So now I go back to the corporate world. I was blessed because of those talents to go out, meet, mingle, and I ended up building relationships at the highest level in my company. My former chairman, a gentleman named Stephen Polk, Caucasian male, but again, you can learn something to benefit from anybody that you present yourself in the right way. And then what I did is I got a task to take our company from the old green screen technology to the new Microsoft Open technology, Microsoft Oracle, and I built a solution called Polk Insight, which is a web-based solution that you can go out and see what vehicle registrations are, what levels, who's driving, where they're driving, so these auto companies can be smarter about their marketing, their product mix, et cetera. Well, then what I did is went around the entire United States and had the task of meeting with all of the leaders at these what we call OEMs, original equipment manufacturers. That's how we define the Toyotas, the General Motors, the Chevrolets, the Hondas, the Ford Motor Companies of the world, and sell them this seven-figure solution, meaning multi-million-dollar solution. Well, long story short, when I walked in, Polk was a traditionally Caucasian company. I walked in as a black male leading the troops. And whether the minorities in the company were part of my group or not, they came out and introduced themselves to me. Which fast forward, I ended up with about over 200 business cards. Well, again, being a person that I want to lead by example and a natural social individual, I called every last one of them. And they told me two things. One, your company is big, Mark, but they didn't have a strong appetite for engaging with minorities. Point one. Two, your company is big. You have all the data, but it seems to be focused on the general market, not in the future majority. This was 22 years ago. I took that to my chairman, created a business case, and therefore I immediately became an entrepreneur, not entre, starts with an I, entrepreneur. I built a multi-million dollar business inside of a billion-dollar business. And thus, we fast forward today, I'm blessed to sit on top of that business as the chief, as a C-level executive, and still run that business, which is national and global, where we help all the auto manufacturers, suppliers, dealers, understand what their strategy should be to reach and perhaps reach African-American, Asian, Hispanic, and the other diverse communities. And then we have the data and the sustainability to help them monitor their success, where they fall short, and therefore they can mitigate those risks. The last point I want to make, Mr. Tynes, I'll close up in this, because I was taught to lead by example and something I developed, which is this philosophy of called LAS, L-A-S, learn, apply, which everybody that has any job in America or around the world has mastered. You learn something, you apply it, day in, day out, every day, 8-hour, 12-hour shifts. The third piece that I put on there, which is S, it stands for share. That's the difference I've seen, not just here, but internationally, that leaders always take naturally. If they learn something, they apply it, do it again, apply it, and they go tell somebody else. Hey, if you do this, you can be better off. By doing it that way, you're going to run into trouble. Learn, apply, and share. So now my mentoring comes in. And again, based on the way I was raised by my parents, I'm at a position now where I can give back. And I went right back to the heart of the place that needed, which is the inner city here in Detroit, which is where I reside. And I looked at who's perceived as the worst school on the west side of Detroit, Cody, which is where I'm from, happens to be where I'm from. I bring those kids out to my office along with the only male academy that's underfunded in Detroit, which is called Loyola High School. They bring those kids. I do 45 kids a semester, so that's 90 kids a year. I bring them out to my office. I feed them well and teach them the unspoken rules of corporate America. So I'm ending on this. I look at, and I talk to Dr. Mary Lee, and what you all are doing is, I think, is outstanding. And on a scale of 1 to 10, I think you all are up at the 7, 8, 9 level, talking about fiscal responsibility and funds for entrepreneurship. And as I explained to Mary Lee in the prior conversation, I believe I'm firmly down at the 1 through 4 steps. I'm trying to arm our future leaders, high school juniors and seniors, with the tools, male and female, that when they can grow up and be positive gentlemen and young ladies, that hopefully someday can engage together, make a great family, and continue to contribute to American success within the black community by knowing that, hey, we got to clean up our own house, first clean up ourselves, and then clean up our own house before we can run over and try to tell somebody else what they're going to do at their place. And if we clean up ourselves and clean up our own house, meaning clean up, you don't have to change the hairstyle or whatever, but present yourself, looking people in the eye with a firm handshake, speaking up, speaking well, taking all the uhs and duhs and all these lazy characteristics out of the system. And therefore, the person on the other end of exchange says, I have to respect and appreciate that family, whether they're black, Latino, white, et cetera. We put ourselves right back on par with everybody else by first focusing on ourselves. And I can't go tell somebody else to clean up their house, and I'm doggone sure not going to run to no march or anything else if my house is not in order. If I got to walk over trash and things that are within my scope of management, then only then can I go and help somebody else once I've helped myself. So I'll end on that, but that's who I am, and that's what I do, and that's how I try to give back. And those are some of the solutions I want to push down, help us implement nationwide where I'm doing it right here in Metro Detroit.
Well, thank you for that, Mr. Bland. We certainly appreciate it. The last question I have before I turn it back over to the other guests and panelists on the show so that they can ask some questions is to you personally. And I wanted to ask, because you mentioned that you had a passion and aptitude for data analytics and problem solving ever since you were young.
Yep.
Would you be able to tell us, in your opinion, what you believe has been your biggest accomplishment so far in your field?
So, okay. I like what you put on that end, the biggest accomplishment in my field. I have many. The biggest one was creating the world's largest data store on diverse consumer everything so that I can uplift one of the biggest industries, meaning from an employment monetary standpoint, which is automotive. And I'm known from east to west and north to south. And I've made that known because of my hard work and my continuous drive for improvement. And I provide resources to the most senior people in automotive, the middle management, and the new coming professional pipeline that is helping create a focus on our people. And thus our people are benefiting with not just jobs, ownership opportunities. When I think about the minority dealers, there's no broke dealers in this country, but I've helped in my way by providing data that has helped big companies focus on minority dealers actually sell more of their inventory to these future majority consumers than their Caucasian peers. And thus, these organizations working with a company like NAMAD, National Association of Minority Dealers, has empowered and placed more black males and females, Hispanic males and females, Indian or Asian males and females with dealerships. These are multi-million dollar opportunities, and I help drive that with the analytics and data and foresight, and also being bold to speak up and speak out no matter who I'm talking to. Be the CEO of the biggest auto company in the world, or it could be the lowest level analyst, and I'm going to share the same message. I'm always the same. That's my biggest accomplishment, I believe.
Excellent. Appreciate it.
No problem.
Dr. Mary Lee, or anyone else on the panel, any of the other guests, if you want to ask any questions, just to make sure I don't take up too much of the time.
Okay, so thank you very much, Michael. We'll come back to you, but we'll ask Dr. Long, are you here? If you would introduce yourself and to our audience, and I believe you already know our guests, and share a little bit and maybe ask us a few questions. Dr. Long.
Hi, again, I want to thank you, Dr. Mary Lee, for the invite. And I really appreciate our guest, Mark Bland, for taking out the time to share his thoughts and his unique talents. One thing that I've seen Mr. Bland do personally is, again, his commitment with the youth. And what comes to mind as I'm sitting here today, December 1st, is earlier in the year, I believe it was this year, we all have these local stores in the neighborhood. Well, I shouldn't say in the neighborhood, because there's not one of these stores in Detroit. It was a Lowe's store on Telegraph and Southfield. And, Dr. Hines and other members on the panel, Dr. Davis, they know I'm a one of my hobbies and therapies is really flowers and plants and things like that. And I went into this Lowe's looking for some plant or a pot, and I saw this group of young men, very eager, motivated, and it was almost like they were in a huddle. And in the center of this huddle was Mr. Mark Bland. And I just took a step back and said, wow, this is putting it in action. And he had these young men, and most of them, if I recall, were in some areas in terms of their college education. But he was spending time with them dealing with a practical endeavor in terms of fencing and doing a lot of really roll-up-your-sleeve type of activities. So if I could, I'd like to ask Mr. Mark Bland, how are you able to balance, the corporate world and all that comes with that, all the isms, while also spending the amount of time and energy that it takes to really encourage our young men and women, particularly of this the last two generations. So how are you able to, quote, balance that?
So I right off the top, thank you, Dr. Long. I appreciate that. I remember when you did see me there with the crew, man. So let me first, I'm going to answer that, but let me first say, yes, I'm proud to do what I do as a C-level exec in automotive. I'm proud to be a mentor that has adopted three schools here in the city of Detroit and actually work with them once they up and get in, not just my dollars, but I get in there and physically work with them as the lead mentor. But thirdly, I do own, we have a family business. It's called Emblem Fence Company. And me and my crew, we get out on the weekends, which is my free time. But what I do is we provide a lower cost option for those in the urban community that want a nice fence, chain link, wood, or aluminum, but can't afford the big box prices. And we get them straight, and it looks good, they feel good, and therefore we put them on par with other folks that have deeper pockets, and they can protect and beautify their homes as well. To Ms. Dr. Long's point, what I have done is enlisted the help of my stepson, and in the past my biological sons, and their friends, to teach these young men, one, how you can make money doing something that you like to do, two, have the skills to be that young man that, hey, going back to what I said, you got to take care of your home. If you got a light bulb you got to change, or you need to put up some drywall, or use a drill, a hammer, a grinder, a miter saw, first you know what these things are and you know how to use them. These are invaluable life skills that these young men get. Plus, as my uncle taught me, hey, nothing comes to a sleeper but a dream. So ain't no laziness around me. If you're lazy, you got to go find somebody else to hang around. Get up early, get something done, some honest, earnest money. So when you make it, whatever you, if you save it, great. If you buy something with it, you're going to keep that instead of taking the short, quick, fast route, but then putting yourself in all kind of peril and danger. So you ask, how do I do it? First, I got to give credit to God, which I'm a believer. I pray whether I'm in church or I'm at home. I believe that I just have a personal relationship with God, and he drives me to do great things. A close second for me is my wife, Miss Maria L. Bland, and she gives me the power and drive, and belief, which when I'm doing great, she gives me a pat on the back and says, baby, you do it, you go do it. If I turn that left corner, I'm not doing something as efficient as I could be. She is just as quick, all five, four and a half of them, to say, hey, you know you could do that a little better. And I love her for that. And then the family that comes with it. And just the fact that I have this internal drive to just my belief, and again, this goes back to my mother, Diane Bland, that raised me to say, when you pass away, there's three things on your stone. The year you were born and the year that God took you home. But in the middle, that little dash, that little bitty thing is your life. And you want to make that dash be as big as it possibly can be in the eyes of everybody that knew you. And if you do that, you did your part. And I just try to do as much, Dr. Longs and listeners, as I possibly can in any 24-hour day that I'm given. So hopefully I answered the question, Dr. Longs. And thank you again for remembering and bringing that to the attention of our audience.
Appreciate it. That was a great answer. As you were speaking, and I already know the answer to this question before I mention it, but how do you view the significance of mentoring within the communities in the metropolitan Detroit area, especially in light of the consistent level of, and I'll use the term trauma, that our youth and our population faces on a daily basis. Despite, and as most people know from the international news in this area, we had a shooting in a area surrounding Detroit, which is in the suburbs. It's Oxford, Michigan. But, you know, on the way to work today, I was going to call into this radio station and add my perspective of how to deal with a situation like that. particularly as it relates to our people within the metropolitan Detroit area and even the surrounding areas such as Flint, Benton Harbor, Saginaw. How do we balance not only the ability to mentor with young people, but how do we address, from my perspective, what is a consistent level of trauma, anxiety, fear with our young people as we're trying to motivate them? So yep. Can you provide any specific tips or tools that you use?
Yeah, so first I'll just say, Dr. Long, my family and I, my wife and my youngest stepdaughter, we had this conversation pretty openly, very transparent today. And they asked, what do you think, Mark, is the root of these school shootings, these mass school shootings, not just here in Metro Detroit, but around the country? And I thought about it, but again, I'm an analyst, so I rapidly came back and said, I believe it's the lack of parenting in the home. And so I say that because I'm reflecting back on my childhood and the way my wife raises my stepkids today. Dude, I couldn't pull nothing on my parents. So when I say pull nothing, they gave me enough rope to go out there and see what was around, but I didn't have enough to hang myself. But if I brought anything illicit back into my house, my mom was on it, like, I mean, right now. Hey, if she bought me a bike and that bike was 5 years old and all of a sudden I showed up with a brand new bike, there was one question and then there was a response. Where'd you get that bike from? Whose bike? No, whose bike are you riding? Because I didn't buy you that bike. And if I didn't come with one of my friends that she knew name, which she would say, well, take it back to him or her, then I was in trouble because that meant I did something wrong to get something that she didn't pay for. And so I use that as one example to say all this violence and stuff that you brought up, Dr. Long, always at the core, in my opinion, the root, is some parent provided some kid with a gun or they provided with too much freedom or they say things like, I know they were doing something up in that room. I didn't know what. Well, as a parent, our job is to open that door and find out what's going on. So long-winded, but my answer is what we're doing as mentors is almost like secondary parents. And it goes back to what I mentioned before. This is a solution I'm talking about. When our young people, what I refer to them as future leaders, when they know better, then they are apt. And oftentimes I see them almost like little caterpillars that turn into beautiful butterflies. When you share the information that you know as an older male or female, and it could be your successes, but equally so, it could be your shortcomings. Hey, I did this, and I'll just give a tangible example. I love when I hear somebody say, hey, man, early, I thought I was the flyest dude going after the women and the riches, and I started selling drugs. But that didn't work out for me, man. I spent time in prison. That's not a good place for you. By giving that to another young person, you allow them to do what I call the hockey stick. They're going down the same road you were, and now they can detour to something positive because you've made them aware of what peril could be laying ahead. So what I do in mentor is one of the most fulfilling things I do. I get to share with these young people, and too much too often, it's what you all on the phone may consider basic things. Hey, young man, hold your head up, and when you look somebody right between the eyes, look them square in the eyes, and then shake their hand, and then what I really talk about, my wife gets me up there because I get real loud about it, speak up. The one thing you know when I'm talking to a 16 or 17-year-old kid, same thing with a 12 or 25-year-old, you've been carrying this name, this government name of yours, for at least 16 years. And a lot of times before I coach them, hey, how you doing, son? What's your name? My name is Mark Glenn. What? And I stop them. That's the one thing. That's another solution. As older, mature professionals on this call and all around, one thing we should do is don't let them get away with that. Stop them. I go, whoa, let's run that back, man. This time I want you to say your first and last name. Look at me. And do not rub your hair. Don't do any fidgeting. And say it like you mean it, like I'm challenging you. That's not even your real name. Hi, I'm Mark Bland. Married to Maria Bland. We own a house here, there, and the other place. Speak up and look them in the eye. So what we got to do and what I like doing is helping shape these future leaders. And like I said, the end game is these future fathers, these future heads of households, and the women that they're going to partner with who are also strong leaders and future heads of household, and combined we make a greater and stronger family, first in your own house, and collectively if your neighbor and you're doing it and the people across the street, now we got a stronger community. That's the solution for me. And hopefully I answered your question, Dr. Long.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Thank you.
No problem.
Dr. Mary Lee, that would be all I have.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thank you. Certainly we're going to circle back around. We do, Dr. Tatum, you want to jump in here?
Yes, yes. I want to respond to the same question. Just a little bit of background for some of you who don't know. I grew up in Chicago, and the Cabrini Green Project is one of the worst projects in Chicago. The Gangster Disciples ran that side of the town from the 60s to the 70s before they demolished the projects. Now, the gentrification, they got a high-rise project. We did a gang summit in 2013. My goal was to stop the homicides. Chicago was averaging about 800 to 900 homicides a year. One of the things that we're not paying attention to, and I concur with what the gentleman was saying, you know, most of the homes are, they don't have the father or the mentorships in the community. Women are trying to raise their children. And my son brought this to my attention. He said some of the guys that are in Chicago, they're listening. They got this term out there called DT time. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that. In Chicago, it means demon time, meaning they're operating on this supernatural, spiritual reaction from demonic activity to cause them to go out and just kill with no type of remorse. So we're dealing with a high spiritual situation in Chicago, the recent shootings in Memphis. I was born in Memphis. So we're dealing with an element as a pastor, and I'm going to give you a good example of what I'm talking about. I was preaching about love at my church because I go to church in California, pastor there. And a brother was in my congregation, and I was talking about going and get good counsel. And this young man, never seen him before, he came up to him and gave me a hug. He said, "Pastor, I'm glad you talked about love and reconciliation." He said, "I had an automatic rifle. I was going to go mow down a whole bunch of people for retaliation." So we're dealing with a spiritual element that a lot of people haven't tapped into, where people just take their life without remorse. I just officiated a funeral in California. A 20-year-old young man killed a 30-year-old young man because he was jealous for him talking to or messing with his girlfriend. So we're dealing with spiritual elements as well as the natural elements of raising girls and daughters. The women are complicit because they can set the guys up, because we believe this young man was set up by his girlfriend. So you got to look at the spiritual element that's happening across the nation through music, giving people inspiration to do things they never did before. Even with our younger people playing video games, they have become so callous and so desensitized, where these young people, as they play these games, 9, 8, 10, 12 years old, they are to the point where if they go out and shoot someone, they think it's a video game. So we're dealing with a whole nother level of understanding of violence, and we got to step up as individuals.
And then if I could chime in really quick, I agree with you 100%, Dr. Tatum, when you say we have to step up. I want to repeat a little bit, but that's what I do to try to, when I believe in something. That goes back to Dr. Long's question of mentorship. I take great pride in kind of helping reverse what I call some false stereotypes, or getting people to believe more in themselves than what the street lure would put out there. And so I'll give you an example. Similar to that, not so much the demon piece. Yeah, I'll talk about that a little bit. There was a conversation amongst my mentors, and I want to put it from Cody High, which again is in a rough part of Detroit, is considered one of the worst schools. But in my presence, there was like four or five of my mentees, young men. They started having a conversation while we were on the way to going to the bus. And the conversation went like this: "Man, look, man, all your cousin got shot with was a .22. Man, if I'm going to get shot, I'm going to get shot by at least a .38 because I'm going out big." And the other kid said, "This is me hearing type, like, what is this?" And started walking to the other kid said, "No, it's got to be at least a .357. The other one was like, "No, man, .40 cal, man. Forget that, me, because if I get shot, I'm going to go straight out." I went over and just jumped right into the conversation, said, "What the heck are y'all talking about? Man, that is the stupidest thing I've heard. Look, you don't wish no bad stuff on yourself. You don't have no low esteem conversation about, 'I want to be shot.' Mr. Bland don't want to be shot. I don't want to be around people that's talking about shooting. So y'all gonna bother me? That's the craziest stuff, and it's the first and last time y'all gonna talk about that. And I've had these young people because I insert myself as a dominant older male, which most older males should do that when they're talking to younger males. That's another solution. Cannot cower out from these young people. That's problem number one. That gives them false sense of strength. We have to step up and be who we are. Older, more dominant males when there's younger teen males around. And we have to stop the stupidity. And so what I mean by that, hey, if they're talking about this demonic thing, then, hey, that's where the family or the community that knows them wraps around them. Hey, let's go to church. Let's talk about this. Anytime you're feeling like that, you call me. And we'll do something else, man. Let's go get an ice cream, or let's go do something like, again, let's go get a beer if they 20 years old, 21, whatever. Because I'd rather them do that and be good than to know that they've expressed to me, hey, I feel this way, I'm going to go kill. No, that's going to take out two lives, whoever you hurt and you. So, I mean, we got to step up. And it, to me, it goes back to, it boils down to reach one, teach one, and share what you know. At least if you make them aware and we provide the knowledge where they know better, they will do better. We may not solve all the problems. We can't save everybody. We're going to try, though. But hey, if there's 10 people going down the road and we save two, we are 20%, we're 200% better if they all went off the tracks. That's just my thinking.
Great. Thank you so much. Dr. Moncrief, and I completely agree with, you know, with everything that you said, and this is a very, very, very important topic. Dr. Moncrief, if you are here, would you please tap one on your – oh, okay, great. Go ahead.
Yes.
You just introduce yourself, and then, yes, and then go ahead with any of your comments and remarks and questions for our guests.
Okay. Well, this is Dr. Anita Moncrief, and I'm very, very happy to be on the show tonight and to have participated in the previous sessions. I think the critical race theory needs to be taught, and I think our guest panelist has achieved what we should be teaching our young people, and he's achieved what we should be teaching each other. Mentorship is important. Having a sense of who you are is even more important. I recently went through an experience personally that reminded me, because sometimes I forget that I'm black, but it reminded me that of who I am, and it reminded me that you need to speak up and not just be accept the situation or the circumstances that you're put into. I recently went out for a position that I know that I was more than qualified to achieve, okay? And I didn't get that position. And when I asked the question why I didn't get that position, the answer was the person who made the final decision decided to go in another direction. But he decided to go in another direction without even interviewing me. So he didn't know what direction I was in. So that reminded me. That reminded me that it didn't matter how many degrees that I had or my experiences that I had, that somebody else could had some type of formal authority to make a decision over me. And it was up to me to accept that decision, was up to me to say something about it. And I chose to say something about it. And the more I said something about it, the more I realized that the person who was making the decision was making it not based on facts, but was making it on his own implicit bias. He was using his own microaggressions, who have the credentials, the background, the experiences, not to accept it, but to say something. Otherwise, these situations will keep going. And you've got to teach that to people. You've got to teach that to each other, that you know your worth, you know your value, and you don't allow somebody else to put their opinions on you. and belittle who you are. And by having mentorship programs like this gentleman was saying tonight, you can teach our young people, you can teach them that they can empower themselves through education, through hard work and determination to do anything that they want to do. And you can teach them that by knowing their history, that they can do better. If you know better, you can do better. But you have to know. You have to learn. So I guess I'm making more comments than having questions, but I appreciate the power of a good, strong mentor, a good, strong African-American male teaching our young brothers coming up, brothers and sisters coming up, power of a good African-American female. Thank you.
Oh, thank you for that. That was great. That was warming to my heart. I appreciate that. Can I add two more things really quick, Dr. Mary Lee?
Yes, of course. Yours.
So okay, two examples. One, it is somewhat, it's very humbling, a tablespoon of disappointing, but equally so encouraging. Every semester when I get that first wave of kids, 45 come through, and I say this like, it's like 60-40 female to male. But that 40% male, that when I greet them outside when they come off the bus, and I watch and observe, and the first day, those ladies grab those door handles, and those gentlemen stand back, and it's like every day until that day. And I stop them. Hey, from this moment forward, anytime a female is in your presence, meaning in your periphery, if you see them coming, they're behind you 20 feet. You slow down and you wait, brother, and you hold the door open. And I don't care if they're older, way younger, right in the middle with you, whether you're attracted to them, not attracted to them, speak your language or not. If they female, you hold the door. That is a rule. Gas station, car door, church door, house door, any door. Act like they don't have any arms. And it's funny. I've got my wife and my kids are now trained. They'll stand right there like they got no arms when they're in the presence of me, my stepson, and all those young men that Curtis, Dr. Long said to their Robin. They've all figured out. But what I like is that once I explain it to them and why that's beneficial and how that's going to differentiate them, they rise right up right away. Second, this thing about sagging pants, and I know if there's urban designers or whatever on the call, they're gonna come after me or whatever. I'm good with it, brother. Come on. But it's bad. And every year, again, they come in, 50% of them got their pants down around their waist. Stop them right there. And I ask them, hey, where does sagging come from? And it's so funny when you ask and you engage young people, which are our future. Those are the future leaders, the future homeowners, fathers, et cetera. Oh, prison, jail, you know, gay activity. Okay, so I heard y'all say, and it's good when you let them speak in their own words because that peer pressure really worked. Okay, so now I want to see a show of hands. How many people's plan is to be a prisoner? Not a single hand in the room. If you're a heterosexual male, how many are you going to convert over to the other side? Again, if. And it's nothing wrong with either way, but how many of y'all, not a single hand in the room? So ask them, so why do you do it? And there's always one brave soul when you press the question and don't try to answer it for them. They say, man, because everybody else is doing it. So ask another question. Do I have a room full of leaders or followers? And the first day, disappointed, I'll tell you, only one or two hands will go up. I'm a leader. The rest of them, they sit there because it's this whole thing, this whole epidemic. We always talk about coronavirus. There's a pandemic right in our community. It's called being chill. And it's took over our kids' brains. It's, you know, everybody talking like they done smoked a whole whatever, and they, you know, man, yeah, like they moving in slow motion. And that's got to die. And through mentorship, we have to kill it. So what I teach them, I give very tactical things. I'm talking about another solution now. I tell the young men, because they always want to try to find a way out. That's young people, period. I was like that, I guess, when I was young, too. I said, here's the rule. Anytime you have on pants, trousers, slacks, shorts, whatever you want to call it for the day, if it has belt loops on it, then you must fill those belt loops with a belt. And you will believe how they look around and they look at each other and call out each other. But starting day two, they come in and they're proud. They're proud. Mr. Bland, look, look. Got my belt on, man. It's, my pants are around my waist. And they feel better about themselves. So my last tactical point or solution is we got to give love. And I'm not saying that in a hypothetical way. We have to reach out and get involved in these young people's lives and stop the stupidity early. When you see it, stop it and give them an alternate solution. And the last thing I'll say is a tragedy piece. I had a young lady, because I go out and I give the same passion I'm giving to you on this call, I give it every one of my sessions. Anybody that knows me will tell you, Mr. Bland comes with it, and I reach in and dig in. And then once you do that, they befriend you. They feel appreciated. They feel respected. That's all they want. That's all young people want. They're seeking that all the time. I had a young lady come back to me, and anytime she's a young lady, what I do is get one of my female counterparts, one of my female professionals, sit down with me because I'm not having a conversation with a young lady, 16, 17, by myself. But we sat there, and she said, hey, I'm embarrassed to say, but my problem is my mother and my auntie, which is another piece that we want to talk about later. My mother and my auntie, when I turned 16, which I'm 17 now, when I turned 16, they said, hey, your mama gave you that body. We got rent to pay. You need to get out here with your aunties and all this and do these bachelor parties or whatever they're doing after hours things. So I'm 53 years young. I've been exposed to that kind of stuff. I can only imagine what that young lady had to do to try to help support her family. The people who were put on this earth to protect her were actually putting her in a line of peril. So what I did is I said, hey, listen, you, to your point, Dr. Moncrief, you got to know your worth. And sometimes, again, I'm not telling you go and be totally belligerent against your parents, but you got to say, hey, that's not what I see myself doing, near term or long term. And if I'd rather just stay back, if I need to have less money or whatever, I want to focus on being whatever her career goal is, what her lifetime goal is. The young lady started crying. I turned over to my female counterpart, but she came back and said, you know what? I really appreciate y'all. Y'all showed me love. And now here's what I want to do. I'm going to keep good my grades. I'm going to go to college. And that young lady's off doing positive things now. That's what gives me the most joy and satisfaction, is being almost like having an intervention. I'm not going to dog out your parents. That's not my thing. But it's a way to just talk to them around it and massage it and just get involved in their life. And if they're kind of going off the tracks, show them, Dr. Mark Friedman, that they have intrinsic value, and here's how you can achieve and realize that value.
Then my That's comments. Awesome. Thank you. That is so very awesome. I'm just going to make a quick comment regarding the your teaching, your mentoring your young men, and in regards to, you know, showing courtesy, you know, to the women, opening the doors, and as a single parent, these are some types of things that I taught my son. I had one son, one daughter, and I grew up with this. You know, I grew up with my dad doing the same thing and teaching, you know, my siblings, my brothers, and, you know, and the entire family this type of respect and care and protection. You're protecting the female too. And so, and growing up this way, instilling in my children, you know, and as a woman, if I go into a grocery store and I approach the door, if there's a man behind me, I don't care what nationality he is, you know, I just step aside, and you don't even, you know, it just automatically happens. Does that make sense? It just automatically, whomever is behind me, whether it's black, white, young, or old, they know to open that door, whether they've been taught it or not. I've been taught it. And so all of this just makes a difference, and are things that we need to know, things that we need to teach our children. I mean, we've got a lot of hands up, but we want to go to, I want to acknowledge Mr. Robert Jameson, who's on, and we will, before you speak, sir, I want you to know that your line is open. I welcome you. And we want to go to Dr. Tynes. He's been waiting quite a while now. So we're going to Dr. Tynes, then Mr. Robert Jameson, and Dr. James Cannon. Thank you for being here. I know you're here, and we will be getting to you very soon. Thank you, Dr. Tynes. Tynes. You are live.
Thank you for Dr. Lee. Thank you, Dr. Long. Thank you, special guests and Mike. I've just celebrated 31 years of Reach Out to Youth for the Future Doctors and Leaders of Tomorrow. We just did that at Wayne State University. Me and Dr. Carolyn King started that back in 1989. And it was based on African self-esteem and having the kids be doctors for a day at Wayne State Medical School. Back then, the key thing that we found coming out of the positive Public Enemy, Boogie Down production, X-Clan era, and then the FBI and the other media coming in with nigger rap, gangster rap, et cetera, one of the things that still plague us today in 2022, I'm going to take it, 2022, is that I still mentor like the young man who's speaking and talking with the kids and using their reference point. The thing that they've openly said on the radio show that I had was producing was that the parents were the problem, and that the parents didn't really care about them, they really cared about weed, and that the parents were bad examples or role models because they focus more so on, you know, drinking and smoking and partying. The other thing that I found out, I addressed the issue of sagging. And how I addressed the issue of sagging, I was willing to sponsor making a video for YouTube off of Gin and Juice, except walking down the street, watching that booty. I got my mind on your booty and your booty on my mind. And we were going to have a guy looking like Humpty Dumpty, white guy in the car, and all the guys pulled up their pants. And so I had to do an analysis, and the analysis wasn't flattering, because when you traced, yes, it's from the prison, but who made that into the culture and made money off of that was a guy named Russell Simmons. And so the white executive producers are the ones who dictate this artificial black culture. They're the ones, when if you look at now the productions of Power, Black Mafia Family, Empire, all of these things is a white person's perception of what they think black people should be. And because it's a media, which is the number two product that's shipped out of America, entertainment is the number two product that's imported out of America, that also gives an image to the rest of the world of who we are in terms of being Negroes and niggas. And it also sets the stage where kids model and imitate. So our people trying to make the dollar portray an image like, from a white creation, good times, all of that, exploitation that we call it, that is the culture that we see right now. That's the culture that people are imitating. That's not black culture. That's white culture using black actors to affect that. The program that we've done, Reach Out to Youth for the Future Doctors of Tomorrow, has produced many, many doctors, even in the city of Benton Harbor, where we had the lead crisis, that in this city, that's one of the poorest, we wind up producing three doctors and a lawyer. But what was powerful and is still evident in 2022 was that when I went from Detroit to Benton Harbor, I could not do my future doctors program because the self-esteem was so low, which is at an all-time low right now, and that's the fault of the adults. That's the fault of the parents, the uncles, the aunts, the grandparents, the great-grandparents, because we shut it down. We sold our race out after the Civil Rights Movement, we no longer use that to unify and give self-esteem to the kids. Everyone teaches about the greatness of their race except the African-American race, that we want to include everybody else, people of color, people of this, people of that, but we don't stay black. We want to include people of this, that, others, but we don't focus on the black, the only one that doesn't, only human species that don't do that. And so what was found when I came to Bend Harbor, after I studied the people for 2 years before I even opened my mouth to do a program, was I had to first do the I Am Somebody Club to these people who average income, mean income, was $10,000. So the average mean income now in Bend Harbor is up to like $13,000. So that's the mean average income, and that's because the Whirlpool had came in here and raised up the mean income of this population of 10,000 people. And so once I did the I Am Somebody Club, then we were able to turn things around. Back in 1889 to 1990, through our Reach Out to Youth, we were able to increase the number of African Americans going in the field of medicine and science by changing their mindset and self-esteem. We had them come in and learning correct black history up front. There was no stepchildren, there's no step nothing. We're just all God's children. We're just the descendants of the Most High, that one God. Giving that concept to them, focusing at home and not going abroad, that like the gentleman said, the African-American house is dirty, is in shambles, and we want to go help everybody else but us. We have a problem with ADD. We have a problem with ADHD. ADD means absent daddy disorder. ADHD means absent daddy at home disorder. We have that problem, but we have to always do the analysis. And the analysis shows that my specialty was Egyptology. My goal was to explain how Egypt lasted 10,000 years and then fell, and how Egypt fell and how we have fallen as a people around the world, especially here, is that you do not attack the warrior class. You do not attack the man. The man is but a shield that buys time for the woman to build. The man is but a shield that buys time for the woman to build. So you attack the woman. Egypt kept bouncing back, except when the Arabs came in, or the Persians. They're really Persians, because Arabia is part of Africa, and they took that over, and we call it Arabs or Arabians, but they're actually Persians. When they came and took over, they did not come with the sword because they saw that they were unsuccessful. They went after the woman. They went after the woman. They married the woman. And then years later, they took those children, made them feel superior to the African, and enslaved the African. So the African slave trade started 500 years before the European slave trade. So what you do now, you take black people who don't know their history, and you call them the Urban League, and you have the Urban League produce homes that for only for mothers and children, and so that the daddy cannot be in the home. So we have our own people causing ADD and ADHD and thinking this is great. We have our all people saying that we're less than, in terms of that we are called minorities, even though we are 2 billion majority in the rest of the world. So what happens is that the corporate world that lets us in does us in, because what happens is we become black skin but white in. We become black skin but white in terms of our behaviors and our actions. So Dr. Moncrief is making the point that in medicine, our number in 1889, 2% of all the physicians in the United States were black, and particularly black male at that time. Now in 2021, less than 1% of all physicians in the United States are black. So all the, and then Dr. Claude Anderson did a study and showed that all the economic indicators for the African race, we are doing worse. We are going backwards. We're decreasing to the third place in terms of in minority population. So all the stuff that we did trying to be universal with everybody else has failed. So right now, I'm going to ask the speaker, what I've been doing is fighting to try to create a boy shelter in the city of Bend Harbor and trying to use black role models to do my underground trade school, because the black male does not have the connection and understand that we're nation building. The black female doesn't have the connection that we're nation building. So therefore, how can we generate this new concept? We need our kids to black up and not white up. We need them to academically tighten up, not white up. We need them to blacken up in terms of the African culture, and their mores were more sophisticated than those of Europe, and those were adopted by Europe. The early writers tell you that, as well as the 700-year rule of Africans over Europe. So we need to internally look at ourselves so that we can bring our kids up so that they're proud to be black, loving black, supporting black, doing black, because we have not accomplished that. Even in your company, corporation, we have not been in a position where we can have a black economic base, even though we have Dr. Claude Anderson spending all his money to bring about the 1866 Indian Treaty, to bring about the reparations we did with John Claude, you know, with John Conyers, and the people don't even know that we still have a living historian right here, a living model. So how do we stop being ashamed of being black, that we can make our kids feel black, and that black is beautiful, that black is knowledgeable, that black is fine, because that was the first sign of ability. How do we do that in our mentorship? How do we make sure that we are projecting the image of the pharaohs, of the kings and queens of Egypt and Ethiopia and Sudan and these places, and not let's be the best black white man that we could be, because we have to bring an end to Matoris manumission, because it has not helped us. There is no indicator that shows that if we try to whiten up, that we're going to brighten up our situation. We had a black mayor that dropped a bomb on the family called MOVE in Philadelphia. We had a black mayor that allowed poisoning for like 4 years or 5 years of lead in the city that I'm at. So we have our own people doing us wrong. So how do we change that mindset? How do we put the black self-esteem in there? Because we're the only race that don't do it. And how can we interject that on a lower level? Because on a corporate level, it's going to be pushed down. Because I also am the chair of the Systemic Racism Task Force for the city of Benton Harbor. And what happened is we actually blocked Huntington Bank from just willfully just moving out all the black workers and replacing them with white workers. And I identified the Huntington Bank that sometimes it's not the institution, but it's the individual. So how do we bring a collective unity together of blacks like yourself, like Dr. Longs, like Dr. Moncrief, so that the young people can sit down with us and we make sure we keep our mouths shut and listen to what they say, because they say it, but it's kind of, you know, almost have to have a translator, so that we can change the trajectory of our race, because we are headed to the toilet if we don't do something different. Thank you.
Yep. Let me unmute. And I believe that was Dr. Tatum, correct?
No, that's Dr.
That
Tynes.
Tynes. Okay, sorry. You mentioned Dr. Tatum, Dr. Lee. So Dr. Tynes, thank you. So first, Dr. Tynes, I want to say that I have participated, not me, but my son, Mark Jr., he went through your future doctors at Wayne State, man. That was really, really cool, man. I love the program. And he's 19 years old now. And one of his coolest things was, man, you had the eyeballs there at the organs. And it was a cow eyeball, but still he got a chance to see what it looked like and all that. And that was through my sister, Dr. Kiva Blanche. She's a surgeon with the DMC. So,
amen.
Yep. So I think my answer in short is I'm a 53-year-old male, and my suggestion, this is, again, I don't tell grown folks what to do, but suggestions, the teachings and or the preachings that you just shared, the learnings, for this current generation, since they're the internet kids, and unlike us, we used to go to the library and get a book that old, what was it, Dewey calendar thing that you go through and pull the thing out, get the card, go upstairs and find it. They have a question, they pull out Google, they get it in like 3 seconds. And so what we have to do to make sure we get through that, I've learned this through my mentorship, is break it down into digestible chunks, keep it light. And like you mentioned, hey, you know, let's make our, you know, we are the warriors. So maybe that's a theme for today. So you're teaching them the history, but not inundating them with a history class, because that could potentially turn them off. But hey, today's theme is we are the warriors. And hey, there's a 2-minute blurb on, you know, when the Moors came and they did this and they conquered and blah, blah, blah. And you're a descendant of that. So don't let anybody tell you that you can't achieve anything you want to achieve, and you spin it into today and with some history and a powerful message. And then to your point, let them open up and say, so what does that mean to you? Hey, that means that, man, you know, as a student, if right now, if I got a C average and I got people in my school telling me there's no way I could be an A student, I'm going to prove them all wrong because I'm a warrior. I could get that A. I could be that A student. Or as the one, Dr. Marcus, hey, you know, hey, I'm trying to get a job. When they told me no, you know what, because I'm a warrior, I'm going to keep beating down these streets, and I'm going to get that job, and I'm going to get a job, and I'm going to show the other people they made a mistake. And I'm going to go back, and I'm going to save my money and build my money, get my education, and I'm going to go buy that dang store. I mean, and I think that's my suggestion on how, if I was incorporating into my program, that's how I would attack it. And just keep doing it and winning over and shaping one warrior at a time. We're not all going to get it at the same time, but I think you're doing what I was listening to you, what you're doing in Benton Harbor and Metro Detroit is you're uplifting the kids and showing them what they could be. And I think that's the key, is showing them a positive path to realize that goes with the Young Doctor Program, a future doctor program at Wayne State, which I think is phenomenal, and other things. But if we go into too much history, then what happens is that bell curve, and I'm talking to all the educated folks on the phone, yep, they go up, they're engaged, and if we go too long, then that bell curve really slides down the other side real fast, where they go, man, I went, man, I ain't going no more, man. I hate history at the doctor's place. Just give them one bit, let's hype it up, and instill some empowerment in them, and I think, and for me, again, I could have went to a historical black college, and me personally, I didn't. I didn't think, in retro, I don't think that would have been the best thing for me. I knew a lot about blackness, and I know I'm all black. I needed to go to a Caucasian or white college, play ball, and all that. Best experience of my life. But what it taught me is that, one, not all white people are bad. Two, I need to figure out how to work with and talk to them so I can be successful in whatever I was trying to do. But what I also learned, because I am all black inside and out, is that whatever gold that I dig up out here doing whatever I'm doing, I'm bringing it back to this all black house that me and my wife own. And the last thing I want to say is, we were talking a lot about the broken homes and stuff. There's equally as much to say about, hey, where does a two-parent home or one strong parent home that you've got the tools to then now share? And I'm very proud to say my wife and I, our door is open all the time. So our kids, friends, they love being here. And we drop those jewels on them. Again, to my point, I'm trying to be a leader by example. I don't sit down and preach to them a long time. I just, hey, you know what? By doing this, you know what? You stepped your game up. And they pick up on it. And when we travel, we take some of our family members with us that may not have the fiscal means that my wife and I do, and we expose them organically or naturally while we're doing it, and therefore it opens their horizons to say, you know what, my aunt, my uncle, our cousins do this. They took us. We love it. I'm going to do some of the things my aunt, my uncle do. So when I get there, hey, then I can do that too for my kids and my family, and it just keeps building the chain. So hopefully I answered your question. I would just break it down in digestible chunks. Don't shy away from your message. Just small chunks that they can digest, and then show them how that relates to today, and let them talk about amongst their peers the challenge they face and how they can demonstrate, using one example, that warrior mentality.
Right. I want to co-sign on that. I want everyone to know what happened. I did that in sound bites, you're right, and letting them go take it. What happened for the football team of this year, that I introduced the concept of A square, mean like, you know, to Ann Arbor, stuff like that, but they've been academic athletes. And by doing the sound bites, doing a little history, for the first time, half of the football team was on honor roll. half of the football team was on honor roll, and we even had the academic athlete who was failing last year and now got a 4.0 because he was a 4.0 for this year, even though he was a D for last year, by giving the academic self-esteem, letting them know they come from kings and queens, they come from greatness. The phrase was, when you know your history, you know your greatness. But those little sound bites shocked the school system, shocked me, because I didn't know it was going to be successful. But over half of the football team on a roll, I created a T-shirt that I was fighting the other black coaches, and on the back of the T-shirt it says, one team, one family, unity equal to win, and I helped some of the kids make sure that that phrase jived with them when we juggled it around. But you're absolutely right, sound bites, and they will respond. But the self-esteem is what's killing them. So my killers, my murderers that I deal with and Dr. Long's deal with, it's a self-esteem issue. And we play our history so cheap, so low, that gives us our self-worth that we can stand up against other people. But we don't have that. Our children don't have that history of greatness. They only have history of slavery, and that was forced upon us for 400 years, but they never talk about the 30 or 40,000 years of greatness. So, yeah, you're absolutely correct. Thank you.
No, thank you.
Thank you so very much. Sorry, you guys. I want to ask Mr. Robert Jamerson. I want to first thank you for joining us, and if you would share with us who you are, and the floor is yours. So feel free to comment and question.
No, well,
Mr.
first,
Jamerson.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Lee, Dr. Longs, for the invite. He just invited me probably like 10, 15 minutes ago, and I look at the flyer that he sends over, and I see the honorable family friend seen him do the work, Mark Bland, right? So how could I miss this, right? How could I miss an opportunity to be able to be on this call? So I'm Robert Jamerson. I'm the CEO at Detroit PAL, the Police Athletic League, 52-plus year organization, generational impact, not uncommon for people to talk about how it saved their life. And I was a PAL kid, so I'm a product of that. One thing that
and my son
like
is
to
too,
share.
If I could just put that in there. Go ahead.
And so am I. It's good to hear you, brother. So am I, brother.
put it in there. In listening, you know, I needed energy this evening, and being able to hear people who are inspired and speaking with passion at this time of night about not just the manifestation of the culture condition that's taking place in our community, but more importantly, how do we find solutions, right? And so I'm inspired not just by the tone or the energy of how people are saying things, but more importantly, that they're just when you think you're in this battle, and sometimes you can believe you're in this battle alone, but then you hear people in Benton Harbor, or you hear programs that you've heard about, but then you are able to listen to the person that put it in place, or you know your friend that you may golf with and see occasionally is doing this work. So definitely inspired from that. What I hope to share just in a short time is just a couple of the pearls that helped me to reshape the Detroit Police Athletic League into really being the change that you want to see in the community, and really having and seeing the importance of addressing the needs that we see, right? Those needs are socioeconomic, right? Their education and their health and wellness. And so when you think about, yes, the sports organization that's been engaged with the police engagement in the community has been around for years, but even though sports is enough, we're so much more than sports. And if we're talking about excellence is the only expectation or acceptable expectation, then we have to do it. And the only way we could do it is if we understand and we strive to be the very best at collaboration, right? And so when you think about collaboration, what if we understood that and we weren't thinking in terms of competing, and we were thinking in terms of how do we collaborate? For instance, it's so easy for us as Detroit Police Athletic League to look over at an organization like the Boys and Girls Club and say, man, we're serving this and they're serving that. Let's look at what they're doing versus saying, guess what? There's 300,000 youth in the city. We're only serving about 10 to 15 on any given year. They're serving about 6 to 7,000. How do we partner and exchange but compete in a way where we strive to get better? So I'm going to share a couple things and just that I've seen that has not only just resonated, but more importantly, caused our youth to break and unlearn some of the things that they have been programmed to believe, right? And so I think it starts with just being able to help to develop their critical thinking skills and, more importantly, their communication skills. Like Mark mentioned it earlier, we talked about the grunt and the not being able to articulate. We know that is a recipe for failure, right? If they can't articulate, they can't even ask for food when they're hungry, right? And so we have to be able to challenge them in these different ways. So one of the things that we were able to establish at Detroit PAL through some consultant work and then through one of my favorites, Muhammad Ali, who said, if anybody can say it with me, he said, I am what?
Somebody.
Somebody. I am somebody, but I am the greatest, right? I am the greatest. And he starts saying it to the point where not only did he believe it, because we're the ones that we hear more than anybody else in our own head, right? But he got others to begin to say it and believe it, right? And that's how you start breaking this mindset. You start breaking the undervaluing, the marginalizing that now they don't have to do to us. We do it to ourselves, right? And so how do we do that? We created this great model, and you can take notes, steal this, claim it as your own. If it's good, it's going to be good. Whether you say it or I say it, the more importantly is the impact that comes from it. So if you have something and you need to write it down, it's simple. The letters of great all stand for something. The number one thing that you get from sports or youth enrichment or mentoring is the understanding of goal setting, right? Mark can speak to it. When he first went out and he found that there was somebody bigger, stronger, faster, he began to observe. He got a coach, and then he started to role play, meaning practice, to be able to get to that point. When he did that, he started making markers for, I want to be a little faster, so I'm going to set this line in the sand and say, I'm going to get here faster the next time by doing these things, right? And so the first thing we do now at Detroit PAL is we get in front of them this planner where now we have people like you that are on this call right now to begin to say, you come in and talk to them just by relating to the importance of setting goals, asking them what goals have they set, right? And if there's crickets, that's okay, right? But now you pause and allow them to think deeper, and then you begin to work with them on the goals and how they set goals, and then you get them to write it down. If they just do that, they will, we know, if you make the vision plain by writing it down and you begin to track it, not only will you achieve it, but you'll continue to get better at it. The R stands for resilience. I heard the doctor speak around understanding your history. When I think of resilience, we can sometimes be impacted in our environment in a negative way, but there's always another side of it. So you can also be impacted by understanding these heroes and sheroes who've come from the same neighborhood, lived on the same block, went to the same schools, faced some of the same environmental challenges that you faced, that are now using that as a building block or a stepping stone to be able to do what they do. So resilience is, and we learn it from sports, is I ran an extra mile and I know somebody else didn't run it today. So now when I walk, I speak with confidence because I know I've done something in a better way or more than someone else. So I am resilient. So when it rains, I can walk through the rain and still achieve what I'm trying to achieve. The next one, the E, it stands for embracing healthy lifestyles, right? And so we know the food deserts that are in our community. We know the challenges that our community faces when it comes to the health disparities, right? We know that from a health standpoint, meaning that what sports can provide and just being able to walk, right, just being able to run, it can help to build these healthy habits from that side. But then we had to take a deeper look and start looking at when you embrace a healthy lifestyle, it's not when you face this rainy day or this stress that can become overwhelming. It's not if, I mean, it's when, right? And so by preparing them and having to address this mental health, the stigma in our community, meaning that you're weak when you say that you're tired as a male, right? Or that you're weak when you begin to say, I am overwhelmed by what I'm faced with, right? We now are able to bring in the experts like Dr. Longs and Dr. Leno and these other people who can be able to equip them with this wise counsel that we've heard about, meaning that if corporations have board of directors to help them think through adverse times, how do we as individuals believe that we don't need this wise counsel to be there, having a Mark Bland, a Dr. Lee, and these other people that can speak life when we believe there is no hope, right? The A stands for accountability. Accountability is so important. Dr. Long's called me a couple weeks ago and had me talking to one of the youth within the program. And in that conversation, he started off saying things that caused me to cringe. He started saying, I'm a victim of my environment. You know, I don't have this parent. I don't have that. And guess what? We can kick the can just like anything after the bad news comes. But after that, man, you got to pull up your pants. You got to stick it in the ground and be able to take that step. Sometimes you got to step alone. But we know there was nothing great ever achieved without someone else that spoke life or someone else that helped you to do that, right? That's why I'm a big fan in that thing called seed time and harvest, right? Meaning that somebody's watering, somebody's nurturing, somebody's weeding. But at the end of the day, guess what? We made it. We're going to produce that perfect fruit. But it starts with accountability. What are they accountable for? That's the big question. The accountability comes for, they're accountable for their effort, their attitude, their actions, and their behavior. So what you're looking for when you're trying to help a parent understand, how do I pave the way for this youth? I don't go look for this bad teacher to blame it on the teacher. I don't go look for the bad manager that they're going to face another life or this bad coach. I began to look at these things that this person can't control, their effort, right? So do they cross the line with the same speed, the same tenacity, no matter if somebody's screaming, whether it's raining, or whether they're having a bad day? Because they can control that. So that's what I'm getting the parents to look at and to be able to say, this is the seeds that can produce this perfect fruit if you can get them to focus on their effort. But what about that attitude? Look, on a rainy day, do you decide this is the rain that's going to provide the nurturing for the growth of the things that we see? Or are you going to say, this is the excuse for why I want to sleep in today? They control their attitude, right, and then their actions and their behavior. If you can get them and you can get parents to focus on those types of things, then they understand that it is within their control, right? It's within their control, meaning are you going to confirm what someone said about you, or are you going to be the one that another person sees your effort, they see your attitude, and they say, that man or that woman don't know how to bring out the best. You give them to me, and I'll show you what we can do with this person, right? The final thing is T, meaning teamwork. Police Athletic League, we can't do what we do without having our connection with the police, but it doesn't stop there. We don't just survive off of one entity. It takes a coalition to change the things that we're trying to change. If there's a systematic approach to the challenges that we face in our communities, you can't take one approach. You can't say, well, Mark Bland's approach is the only way that we need to do it. No, we need a Mark Bland, we need a Dr. Lee, we need a Dr. Long, we need a this person, we need all these different approaches, but it starts with collaboration, because if we come together, we maximize our resources, we maximize what we do. Detroit PAL doesn't do literacy, but we partner with Brilliant Detroit. They do literacy, but what will we do? We the Pied Piper kids. We bring those kids in front of that educational literacy program at 4-8 to be able to get them there through our mentorships. And now those resources get used. In a nutshell, what do we do in the community? We'll break it down like this. We provide awareness, access, or utilization of resources. Plain and simple. It still takes the effort of the people that get in front of those things, meaning if we make them aware because we're a trusted source, we get them to use it because we're a trusted source. And then finally, in order for anything to take place, they got to take that next step. Utilization starts with them as well being accountable for that. So I just wanted to share that. I don't want to take up too much time, but I just want each of you to know that, man, it takes all of us. I appreciate the call today. I got to jump off and jump with my 5-year-old who I got to make sure that I don't become depleted when I get home and I'm not investing in him like I invest in other people. But, man, know that the work is real. Know that it's more than talking about what the problems are, and it's all about what can you do to be the difference that you want to see in the community. So I thank each of y'all for giving me this opportunity. And Dr. Lawrence, you know, put me on the call where it took some of my time, but I've enjoyed it. Mark, can't wait to get back out on the golf course.
Hey, Rob, don't go real quick, just 30 seconds. All I'm going to say is Dr. Lee, Dr. Cannon, and the rest, as you can hear from this eloquent brother here, which, again, proud to call him family. He's definitely a friend, but he is family. And yeah, he's a tough little competitor on the golf course, too. He's not little. He's about 6'6". But he would be a great panelist to have on a future call because this brother has, as you can tell, so much to share. Mm-hmm. And if I may embarrass him a little bit, went from a super lucrative opportunity being one of the leaders, senior leader in the drug market, not no illegal drugs. He was doing it very legal mm-hmm. with a group called Pfizer. Left that and came back to this committee, which we served. And him and I were part of, PAL and many others. And he took that PAL program, which has been existing. I'm 53 years old since I was born. I participated and has turned that whole thing around because he really believes in what I call those future leaders of tomorrow, both men and young women. So he would be great to have on here to help you with this whole critical race theory, racism in America. Focus on solutions because he's the brother that I know and I can attest to. He'll take the problem, but he also is quick to come with one or more solutions.
Trust me, you all are going to hear from me again. Before all of you jump off, we want to, and I know Dr. Tatum has to go, but I do want Dr. Cannon to come in here and speak to all of us. Dr. Cannon is really responsible for our being here today, simply because like a couple years or so ago we met, and he pushed me out here. I mean, he had me hosting a show about Dr. Cannon. Was it 10 minutes before the show? And even when I was on the show, I didn't know that I was hosting the show. So he's my co-producer and our host, Dr. Cannon.
Beautiful, ladies and gentlemen. I appreciate you so very much for a whole lot of reasons. This show, as like so many, has stirred my heart. Namely because I hear the hearts of so many different people. And one person said, if we all do what we know we need to do 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, there'd still be a whole lot of stuff left to get done. And so it is true that none of us is good as all of us. What we cannot do alone, we can do it together. And just to add a little synergy to what's already been said, the powerful programs, I love them. But, you know, Nick Cannon is my son, and we started with 12 young boys, 10 young boys in North Carolina with the public television station 25, 30 years ago. And those young kids started doing a show, and they had to get it approved by the public access channel that's in the city. And as they got that show approved, those young kids began to interview everybody, the 100 most important people in the city, any celebrity that came into the city. I watched my son's people skills grow. I watched his vocabulary grow. I watched people give those young kids an interview that wouldn't give me an interview. And so I said, wow, that's powerful. I watched my son learn to pitch a million-dollar ideal to all white executives at 17. And I said, that's powerful. If we can get our young kids so polished that they could go into a room with confidence and be able to pitch a million-dollar ideal while we sit on the outside, then that's what we need to do. And ladies and gentlemen, there's a new frontier that we cannot let our young people miss. They get on their they cell phones and their computers, and they spend all night on inventions and creations that other people have created. And so what I've learned is that there's something powerful about this media. And so imagine if we could connect in every city. And Dr. Chimes, you so beautifully as always laid out the state of where we are in our history. My grandmother is 102 years old today, and her grandmother was in slavery, and she poured into her. But I have five sons, and even if I wanted them to understand all the history of my grandmother, I don't want them to miss all of the opportunities that's in front of them. And it is necessary for them to understand the history, but to understand how to, like those spies sitting on the hill, and how to figure out that there's milk and honey flowing down there, but how do we make sure that our young people get it? One of my hopes is if we could connect them to internet shows just like this, like what we've done with Dr. Lee, where we can produce shows out of every church. Let's utilize the churches. We have them. They've been in our history. My great-grandmother that I spoke of, her was one of the first free female slaves to attend the historical black college. So we have black colleges and we have black churches. If we make sure that our young people are flooding those colleges and they're in those churches, I went to the Sunday school. I went to the Brotherhood. And we did discuss the Sunday school class quarterlies. But we were organized and we talked and we had conversations. And I think a lot of our young people need to get back in those churches. And if they can participate in the conversation, then they got a seat at the table. But we got to flood these churches and flood these colleges because they belong to us. And then if we take over the airwaves, the Jewish people came into the community, and the first thing they did was take over the media. Then they took over the print. And then they were able to control the narrative. With this new frontier of the media, if we make sure that give me 25 young people in every church, we'll break them up in five groups. Give me your young people that you have working with your police league in every city, and we'll give them a show. 25 young people, five groups, we got five shows. They could be connected to the athletic department or the connected to the church. But now we got media where our young people are the hosts, like Nick Cannon was at 12. And then I could dictate the questions. I can make sure that he could go to all the corporations and interview them so his knowledge would begin to grow. And so, ladies and gentlemen, I love the energy that I hear, and these shows are so powerful. Let's don't discount our voices. What organizations do we have that have media with our young people connected where it's a national organization? Well, let's create some like the Boy Scouts and the Girl Scouts did, but instead of teaching them to hunt, fish, and canoe, we teach them how to produce, edit, how to go into a room and take the room and take charge and know everybody in the room, how to work the room. Let's teach our young people how to keep these cameras rolling, because YouTube paid out $22 billion in commissions just for intellectual property, for content. So we can produce content, ladies and gentlemen. We can bring our young people together in these churches, 25 young people on a Saturday morning in every church, and now we can mentor them with the cameras rolling. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Lee, I appreciate you so very much. Outstanding show as usual. Let's keep it rolling, y'all.
All right, now, thank you so much, Dr. Cannon. You know how much I love you and everybody. We've just been blessed. That's all I can say. We are working on many, many projects. My role here, Neighborhood Commerce Institute role is here, is to organize us. You know, we're organizing. We're collaborating our businesses and entrepreneurship, and we're creating new. Everything that Dr. Cannon has just said, that is what we're doing. We are creating networks of shows. I know, Dr. Tatum, you've got to go. Come on in here and give us your final thoughts.
Yeah. Thank you, Dr. Lee. It's been a beautiful show talking about solutions, and I heard a lot of great solutions tonight, a lot of mentorship, a lot of one-on-one communication. Dr. Cannon wrapped it up with some of the things he's done with his son Nick and some other young men and across the nation, and he's continued to do it. Even his son Gabriel Cannon is working with youth in California. I just want to say in closing thought, you know, Nick Cannon is the ambassador of the H.R. 1242, the Incredible 400. James Cannon is the president of the Nick Cannon Foundation. And our goal right now until July 1st, 2022 is to raise between $1 to $10 billion to tell the story, continue to tell the story of our 400 years of history in America. H.R. 1242 allows us to do that and to raise money. So our goal is to raise $1 to $10 billion to disseminate that across the nation. Monies have already been disseminated through the commission and grants, forms of grants, and we hope to go even bigger and to do greater things with the help of Nick Cannon and Mr. James Cannon. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dr. Tatum. I just appreciate all of you so much. We're going to anyone who has not had an opportunity to speak, I think, let's see, Erico 3132, last four digits is 2063. You can have the floor, and then we're going to have to kind of wrap it up with our we're going to bring back our co-host, and you know, everyone, we want you to give your final thoughts. Okay, so 2063.
Yes, Dr. Lee, that would be me, Dr. Moncrief.
Yes,
I thought that my final thoughts are, we should teach our children, teach them formally in the classroom and in the home, teach them their values. We should uplift them. We should support them as a group, as a people. We need to do that to each other. It's a simple message, but it's one we keep forgetting. Thank you.
And thank you so much. I appreciate you. Dr. Tynes. Okay, Dr. Long.
Hi again. Thank you for the opportunity, Dr. Lee. I want to give a special thanks to Mr. Mark Bland and Mr. Robert Jameson for stepping in. I knew they would bring a lot of wisdom and a lot of solutions. Like I had mentioned last week, as far as my pledge in terms of solutions, simply stated is to increase my level of consistency in being patient with us, such that we're able to introduce our people, particularly the youth, to a level of understanding of all that's been said on the show tonight. And again, I want to give special thanks to Dr. Mary Lee and Dr. James Cannon and all the other participants. Have a good night.
Thank you so much. Michael. And you can take a few extra minutes.
Are
if
we
you need
wrapping
to.
Up the show, or are we still in the discussions?
You can still ask questions. I guess we should ask our guests, how much more are you still available for a few more moments for some questions?
Yeah, I'm on here. I'm good. I'm just, hey, it's 11 o'clock in Detroit. I'm good. The only thing waiting on me is bed, and it's going to be there.
Okay,
be there,
well,
so
thank
good.
You so much. Thank you. Okay, Michael, go ahead.
Yeah, my question, I had a question specifically for Mr. Bland. I want to touch more on his professional work experience. I know we didn't really talk that much about it. We spoke more so, which was good, about, you know, social solutions in the community, leadership, and other things related to that. But I wanted to get more into, at least for, you know, the few minutes we have you here left, into the data analysis work that you do with marketing to, you know, the different minority groups you mentioned. Obviously, we're specifically speaking within the context of marketing to Black people. My question would be to Mr. Bland, what are some, like, key indicators you rely on to predict with reasonably high certainty when someone is, let's say, a Black consumer, if their name and their race aren't explicitly given or directly accessible? So how do you find Black consumers to cater to when you don't know their name or you can't just look up their race on their birth certificate? But how do you find that they're, how do you locate Black people in the market indirectly? What are some of the best indicators that you use in your analysis process to do that?
Yep. So what we have, as I mentioned before, we have the two best ethnic coding houses in the United States are my direct partners. So when I get a feed of information from a given state, that's one of the sources I get of new vehicle registrations. When it comes through, it goes through these two independent coding sources separately and independently, and then they come back together. And in short, I'll give you a high-level example. And the name that I'll use is one that's known across the nation for a lot of good reasons. He was one of the youngest mayors ever. He's also a friend of mine. I knew him growing up, Kwame Kilpatrick. And I use his name because it's a great example, right? It's just easy to define. So what we do is we look at the old way of coding ethnicity based on name. Said it was just looking at the surname, right? And so his surname, Kilpatrick, in its traditional form, is Irish. So the scale would go up and go ding, 90% likely to be, this driver is 90% likely to be Irish, right? And which, in fact, we all know that would be totally incorrect. But what we've done is we've evolved and moved forward in the science of ethnic coding. And now we look at the first name in conjunction with the last name. So the gentleman's name is Kwame. And so just by the sound, the phonetics of it, Kwame Kilpatrick, you would think, okay, and what the algorithm would say is, in the history of us collecting names, which goes back more than 40 years, we have 40 years of just name history, and people have self-reported and validated and stuff. There has never been a true Irishman or Irishman has given his son the name of Kwame. So we'll go ding, 90%, you know, like 99% not likely to be Irish. So then the algorithm systematically looks and says, okay, let's dig into the first name, Kwame. Just by the phonetics of Kwame, you think African or Middle Eastern. So let's start with Middle Eastern. What our information has taught us and we've learned over time is that Middle Eastern men in the United States are given names with the end and usually strong consonants. So if he was truly Middle Eastern, it would probably be Kwam, Quran, etc. Even when they take American names, it usually tends to be with a strong consonant ending. Sam, not Sammy and not Kwame. So then we rule it out. So no Middle Eastern. And so then what we'll do is then look at the middle name. I think it's Kwame Latif Kilpatrick. And that combination says, okay, mixed race name. And then what our algorithm is smart to do is then we look outside of the name and look at where geographically is the vehicle registered. When he was mayor of Detroit, he was downtown Detroit. And what we found is that people of like race tend to what we call cluster in a geographic. Who was that? In a geographic area smaller than a zip code called a census block group or census tract. And that's no different than Italians living near Italians, blacks living near blacks, Hispanics or Latinas living in close conjunction to each other. So what we do is look at the vehicle was registered in Detroit, Metro Detroit, downtown Detroit proper, which is 85% black. And that zip code is like 90% black. So then what we would do is code him properly as a black or African-American male vehicle registrant. And that's how we kind of get to it in this simplified form. Did that make sense to you?
Yeah, absolutely. I had a follow-up question, though, to
yep.
that. If you don't have a name,
mm-hmm.
is that possible still to determine with, you know, reasonably high certainty? Obviously, this is all probability. Nothing's 100%. But is it still possible to, let's say, I don't know, with 80% certainty, determine based on other factors – other than a name, with someone's ethnicity?
No, we don't do it. Ours is based on because you can't register a vehicle without a name. So we have the name 100% of the time. So that's part of our process, our systematic approach, and our algorithm is to use the name first and then geography because it's illegal to ask anybody or to demand that they give you, you know, their race or whatever. So we just use the given information. We've perfected that science. But as I said before, not to overstate, I said that there's like we're at over a 90% accuracy rate, right? So let's just say if we're 92%, then that other 8% is our delta. I myself, my name is Mark Stephen Bland. I would fall into that bucket where I would say probably 90% of the time I'm coded as a Caucasian male. It's incorrect, but there's that, again, plus or minus. And we're okay with data that can't be legally asked or demanded that we have a 90% accuracy rate. That would be almost like blindfolding you and allowing you to feel the paper and the questions, and somehow you get 9 out of 10 right. We believe that we're rock stars in this game. So we're okay with Mark Bland falling through the cracks as long as we pick up the other 9 people in the room that are my African-American peers or family. We're good with that. And so is the auto industry.
Most definitely. What are some of the most indirect means by which you're aware of that you've seen people in your industry, particularly in the analytics field, acquire information about something like indirectly? So say they wanted to know this thing, but they couldn't directly get that thing. What are some of the most clever or ingenious indirect means that you've seen people take, or maybe that you've taken, to get to something you couldn't get to directly through the analytics process?
Yeah, so it's just that, again, I'm 53 years young, but I've got an old soul, and I just believe the older and equally said more wiser folks, the old way, the tried and true way tends to work. Do your homework, man. Roll up your sleeves and say, hey, there's this tool out here, really, really smart, loaded with information called Google. Then go out there and fill the gaps with some Google research, man, and see what's out on the web. And just make sure you just check the source. If it says, hey, you know, it just has a line, as reported by Mark Bland, maybe. But if it says, hey, you know what, this came from, you know, this source or that source, you know, the U.S. Census, it could be some historical data file by some reputable place, then take it and incorporate it to your mix, and then just make sure you call out the source, and then don't go into it as an absolute and just say, hey, you know what, I'm IHS Market. We have this information on auto buying. But then I also was curious about, you know, what are some of the hobbies and activities that XYZ community likes to do? When I searched on Google, I found that, you know, in this part of the country, African-Americans tend to like, see, that's the key word, tend to like this. Or it's been reported by this third-party source that these are some of the things they do. So car company X, Y, or Z, if you go after and try to reach out and present your goods and services to this community in this geographic area, maybe you would consider partnering with people that are in these kind of lines of hobbies or fields because as long as you just state the fact, and when you say be factual about, hey, this is what I do know to be fact, and this is what I gleaned or pulled from a third-party source, then you're okay. You're being forthright, or as some people use the word, transparent.
Okay, excellent. How often do you rely on external versus internal sources for data?
It's a small percentage for me because, again, we are a large data and insights and consulting organization, so we have most of our proprietary information, and that's what the auto industry leans on us for, is the factual and the high quality of accuracy of our information. And so I would say it's something like maybe 90-10. You know, 90% comes from what I'm known for and what the car company's licensed from me, and I may fill in or add some additional insights or I'll call round off the edges with 10% of additional or third-party research.
Okay. Appreciate it. Excellent.
No problem.
The last question I have to you is, are you concerned at all about any of the acquisition of data, specifically from the Black community that you're facilitating? And if you're not concerned, is there anything you would be concerned about happening? Let's say if, obviously right now, you know, you could say that if there is anything of concern, you could get ahead of it, and you can make sure that if you're in the room, you know, it doesn't go down. But, is there anything that you think could be misused with all this data that's being collected?
So let me take that in two parts. from the position of my company, which I'm proud to be executive leader of, no, I have little or no concerns. Why? We are really good stewards of the information. We don't take that lightly. No one person can receive the information, process it, and then deliver it. I mean, there's accountability across the board because we know the information that we are managing, you know, if put into the wrong hands, could be used for the wrong things. That's not the case with our organization. We pride ourselves on that, and we've demonstrated that we're good stewards of this data. And more importantly, we know that our mission is to use the information to help, again, as I start the conversation with one of the largest industries in the United States and around the world, which is automotive, which each of those individual companies have the same mission and mantra that we do, is to use the information and the insights that come from the information to just create a better experience for the customer, which ultimately leads to a great and long or sustainable experience for an industry as big as automotive. So I say that to break it down simply. A lot of the information is statistical, right, that we provide. There's rarely, you know, individuals unless they're looking to make an offer to you of some kind, which with that, it's all positive stuff. It's not covered. There's no detrimental or derogatory anything that's going on. We won't allow it, and our partners feel the same way. Our partners being the, you know, the OEMs, the equipment manufacturers, the dealers, et cetera. So hopefully that helps. That the majority, I would say 90%+ of the information I'm sharing and I'm analyzing and I'm producing is statistical information. Here's the volume. Here's the percentage of blacks. Here's where there's a large percentage of them where you can go in and reach them and present your goods and services. Here's where you're missing by X percent and you can improve your bottom line by going after this area. And none of that I haven't said anything about Mark Bland, Dr. Lee, Dr. Tatum as individuals. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
So, well, yeah. No, I don't think there's not a harm or foul thing. We're not calling on anybody or saying, hey, when you go over here, this individual has a red, whatever your brand is, right? What we're saying is that, you know, red may be a color that is attracted to blacks because our statistical data shows us that color has been in more demand as we look at the trend over the years. So maybe you want to start to produce more red vehicles. I'm using a hypothetical example. At your auto shows, et cetera, if you're trying to attract African-American buyers. And therefore, it creates a better experience where the desire and, you know, the appetite and the opportunity meet each other and creates a better environment or a better experience for the customer and ultimately our industry.
Okay, wow. Is that substantiated or was that just a hypothetical that typically black consumers, at least in the automotive industry, be like red?
No, that was hypothetical. But I will. I mean, if you're asking for an actual nugget, I'll give out one, which is, you know, for a long time until we came up with, you know, one of the largest LGBT consumer data stores, right? And we received an award from Global Diversity Magazine for this because we broke down a lot of false paradigms. One, there were a lot of folks running around just believing that the LGBT consumer or population was just all white. No, there's Caucasians, there's African-Americans, there's Asian Hispanics. But then I, as a chief diversity officer, not a traditional one, because I don't focus primarily internally about how many of this. I talk about how you can market better to communities that fall into what we call the diverse populations, right? LGBT, military families, African-Americans, Asian Hispanics, women of all cultures and backgrounds, right? These minority or somewhat underserved populations. What we help understand it, and I took that information, the statistical data that I have at my have access to, and what I did is went out and educated a community as large as the automotive industry. So I'll ask you all, and this is the quiz back to you all, if you think about the LGBT community, what do you think are the top three vehicles that the LGBT community purchases in the United States? You know, this name off, what's the first thing that comes to mind? So I said, hey, we're going to do a Pride event, and what do you think are the top three vehicles that they purchase? Anybody, somewhere, anybody. What do you think? What vehicle?
SUV.
I say okay. BMW.
See, okay, that's why I want a specific brand or a model. You said a BMW. Somebody, whoever said SUV, what? A Volvo.
Oh. GMC.
Volkswagen.
Okay, so cool. What I've heard so far, the first couple things I heard was Volvo. I heard a BMW. That you're not wrong. Let me hear you when you say that's what 90% of the leaders in automotive used to think before we put out the data, because there's this false paradigm that, hey, if you're gay or lesbian, again, whether you're black, white, idiot, that you're ultra rich. And that's this false paradigm that somebody mentioned before, the media has put into our heads. And so people act on what they believe, as Reverend Jackson says, what I think and I feel. What we found out, what we put out there, is that the top three vehicles in the United States are all pickup trucks. And in any given order, it could be the Ram, the F-150, or the Silverado. At any given time, that order could shift. But top three are pickup trucks. That's the most sold vehicle in the United States. And equally so, that's the top three vehicles for the LGBT community in the United States. So then based on that, I'm able to go out and educate these senior marketers, these leaders, that if you're going to approach this community, you got to approach it right. And so when you sponsor a Pride Festival or whatever, don't take no super luxury car because that's what you think they buy. And don't take no hydrogen-powered, you know, with wings or whatever that can float on air or water because you think that's what they want. Take and put out your best pickup truck because that's what they buy. Listen, not like everybody else. They are everybody else. The only difference is their sexuality behind a closed door. Everything else, they own homes, they shop. They eat, they have kids, they support sports, all the same thing. So that's...
But Mr. Bland, and I apologize for jumping in here, but there's no way that you could tell just based on their name what you're sharing with us. So there's some other information that you're collecting.
No. So there is other information. So the LGBT comes from a different source that is self-reported, but we have a large volume of it. Thank you for that. That is actual fact. That is factual. That is correct. Thank you, Dr. Lee. But I do have, I just want to give this gentleman that asked me the question of how do I use the data to help educate the industry as large as automotive. That's just one small tactical example.
Absolutely. I know this is the last question. I promise. I know I said the pre-question, but you piqued my interest when you mentioned automotive preferences for people in the LGBTQ plus community, because I also, much like Dr. McCreese, was wondering and was going to ask, you know, what kind of information you collect so that you could actually, with reasonably high statistical power and statistical accuracy or certainty, mm-hmm. predict that someone is LGBTQ plus.
Can we predict what somebody is? You were breaking up a little bit. That's why I'm asking you to repeat it a little bit. You were breaking up when you
okay,
stated.
Okay, all right. Can you hear me okay now?
Now
can you
I
hear
can,
me okay
yes.
now?
Yes.
Yeah, what kind of data would you have to collect or do you collect to, with reasonably high statistical certainty, predict that someone is part of the LGBTQ plus community instead of not? I'm curious about that.
Yeah, so
it seems
the
like
other
a hard
piece,
task.
No, the other piece that I was talking about before was that whole census about the new vehicle buying and your ethnicity, right? Ethnicity, et cetera. That is done on an algorithm based on name, address, et cetera. The LGBT is what we call a specialty data set that we have, and that's through another set of unique partnerships where there have been organizations that have collected this data for a long time, and we have millions of records of self-reported. But as you mentioned earlier, as the chief diversity officer, we've made it very, very clear. We will only use the LGBT data in a statistical fashion. There is no name and address information given out at any time for any purpose to protect those individuals' rights. So, and it all works for us and the auto industry because the statistics is what they really need, is to understand what vehicles are they buying, where are they buying, where should we market to, meaning geographic regions, not individual households. And just like I talked about, instead of taking the most luxurious BMW, we will probably take a 3 Series if I'm the BMW organization. Or if I'm a Detroit 3 or a Toyota, I'm taking a pickup truck because that's what they're buying, and we've educated on what they're buying. Did I answer your question?
Yeah, somewhat. I am still curious about, because it just seems like a very difficult task for, you know, a data analyst to undertake. And if they, you know, find a way to get some success out of that, it seems really impressive, actually, as an accomplishment. So if someone was LGBTQ plus and and they didn't self-report that, does that get pretty much statistically impossible to determine with reasonably high certainty that they're an LGBTQ plus consumer?
It's statistically impossible, right? What we do is we get feeds of information, regular feeds of information of those that have self-reported through one medium or another. We get those feeds. Hey, they've raised their hand and said, my name is Kevin James. I'm an African-American male, but I'm also a gay male. And if we take that, we get that information and we can, you know, merge it with our new vehicle buying information based on certain variables, and then we can produce back the statistics. The statistics. We won't just the statistics. And so that's as deep as we can go, but that's the best we can do, and we're the best at it. And it'd be pretty hard for anybody else to replicate that.
Well, thank you, Mr. Bland, for coming on the show tonight and sharing your expertise and perspective with us. I'm sure I myself I've appreciated a lot of the knowledge that you've given. I'm sure everyone else on the call has also appreciated, and especially the other co-hosts. I know they're really interested in what you specialize in and excited to hear you speak tonight. So thank you for coming on the show again.
Hey, not a problem. It was truly my pleasure, man. Thanks for all your questions, man.
Definitely.
Thank you.
Yes.
I can tell you're an analyst. I can tell you are an analyst.
He is. Michael is our... Are you 22 or 23? I can't keep up. Our young protege.
21.
You're 21?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay. I don't know how I got ahead. So,
cool.
Yes, Michael is our youth expert here, and we just love him. His contributions are always just, like, very, very intellectual, and he educates, and just a young genius here with us, and we can't tell you how much we appreciate Michael, and you've certainly... Go ahead, Mr. Bland.
I was going to say, can I ask Michael a question? So, Michael, I mean, I've shared my background, and you've dug into a little bit of what I do. What do you do, Michael? What is your background? What do you do?
Well, I actually am doing data analytics. And I've been taking some, more online courses, college courses relating to data analytics. So that's why I didn't want to get too specific with my questions, because it might alienate some listeners, but that's why I was more so interested in your professional background in data analytics, is because I understand a little bit more of that side, and I understand, which is the reason I'm actually in the field, how important it is and how powerful it is.
Okay.
So that's what's coming from with my question, a similar kind of background or similar interest.
Hey, not a problem. I could feel it. I want to confirm. So cool, man. No problem. Hopefully I helped.
Absolutely.
Cool.
Thank you so very much, Mr. Bland. Your final thoughts, remarks. I can't tell you how grateful we all are. Me personally, I thank you. I've learned a tremendous a lot tonight, and you will definitely be hearing from us again and again and again and again. I just see this as the beginning of a long-term working relationship. We are here to serve, and not only are we talking about solutions, but we're definitely will be incorporating and collaborating all of the solutions that we have, you know, heard, you know, from tonight, just some rich, rich, rich information. I just can't thank you enough. So if we want to wrap it up, you will be the last voice that we hear tonight. And I want to thank all of our listeners and all of our participants and co-hosts, technical people in the background, everybody who's had any hand in this show tonight. We thank you, and we want to thank your families for lending you to us tonight.
So,
Mr.
Not a
Bland.
Problem. So first, I want to say thank you, Dr. Lee, but equally so, I mean, Dr. Moncrief, Dr. Cannon, Dr. Tatum, of course, my dear friend and family member, Dr. Long. It was great to hear, again, my family member and friend, Rob Jamerson. I would be remiss of me, Dr. Mary Lee, you've put together a great platform. I'm thankful for Dr. Longs and yourself for exposing me to this platform and allowing me to be part of it in some small way. Thank you to all the listeners who, if they're on this call, they are definitely knowledge seekers. I congratulate all of you for that. And I really love that you put the word in their solutions, because too much too often we talk, I guess, in a circle of motion about the problems and the ill wills, which in my humble opinion, we just give people, excuse hangers to hang whatever baggage they feel they have that day on, right? Where today I really felt like all the people contributing were talking about, hey, so here's what I've done. Here's what we can do. And so my final thought is to close out with, I think, some of the foundational things that have helped me. First and foremost, remember, when you wake up in the morning, each of us as individuals, you wake up in the morning, you go into the restroom to greet yourself in the morning. That face that you see in that mirror, at that moment, you get to make a contract with only one person. That's yourself. You have to ask yourself, you know, am I going to be the person today that follows on two things? One, if I know better, will I promise myself I'll do better? And behind that, if I'm doing better, then I should go out and take the approach and opinion. I'm going to lead by example, which in all of that, then you're fulfilling a prophecy with yourself that it, almost like me and my wife talking about, if it's up to me, it will be, right? So before I go and tell anybody else how they should live their life or what they should do or jump into a rally, let me tighten up and make sure that Mark Bland is tight first with myself, that contract I made myself. And my home is good. Make sure my home is good and my person is good. And then, and only then, can I go and then try to lend a hand with somebody else's cause or some other anything. Because we got to take care of ourselves first. And I think that if we do that, that goes back and addresses a lot of the lack of self-esteem, et cetera, and all these other things can fall into place. Because if we do that, then we are making a promise to ourselves that I feel good about me. I know I'm good with me. I'm a warrior or whatever I feel I am that day, and I can go and achieve whatever I want because I've demonstrated it by my person and my place of residence. That's what I would leave the team with, and those are my thoughts, and those are some of the low-hanging solutions that I'd like to add to the conversation. Thank you.
And thank you so much, and again, thank you to you, to all of our listeners. God bless you all. Stay safe until next week. This is Dr. Mary Lee Live. We love you. God bless.
Peace be to God. Peace be to God.